wasn't an article I read, just a photo of a little girl. She was maybe 3 years old, with a mop of curly brown hair, despondent, standing on the ruins of her home, clutching a little teddy bear. Ain't it something how a heart can melt like that, just from a single picture frame? How an image can make sense of everything that matters, and you don't even need to know her name, because we all know children just like her. We want to make them safe and hold them tight, and we can't imagine how someone could do this, create such a sight. She was maybe 3 years old, with a mop of curly brown hair, despondent, standing on the ruins of her home, clutching a little teddy bear. I might forget the details of whatever it was I read, but that photograph is seared in my mind. The photo of the girl that was a photo of all the children, all of humankind. The greatest lessons that I ever could have learned didn't come from all the stories that were filed, nor from all the speeches or statistics, but from one photo of a broken little child. She was maybe 3 years old, with a mop of curly brown hair, despondent, standing on the ruins of her home, clutching a little teddy bear. There's a certain moment, if you're lucky enough, when you might so viscerally understand so hard how all of us are all members of the human family.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, despite rumors of peace in Palestine, the Holocaust in Gaza continues. And nearly 2 years on, Israel's military continues targeting lawyers, engineers, journalists, professors, and all those people whose skills are required to operate a functioning society. Dr. Deirdre Noonan is a Canadian orthopedic surgeon who has spent years in humanitarian medicine working in the field in Central and West Asia, Africa, and the Caribbean. She spent 3 weeks of her summer in Nasser Hospital, Gaza, and is back home now, telling Canadians from coast to coast to coast just what the cost of their nation's continued support of Israel means for the people where its bombs land. I spoke with Deirdre last month. Here's her report back from Gaza's killing fields. Welcome to the program, Deirdre.
Thank you so much.
I saw your presentation, Medicine on the Frontier, here in Victoria in May. There you showed pictures of your colleagues, one of whom you discovered just the evening before had been seriously wounded. Now you've gone back to Gaza again. What's changed, Deirdre, between your two deployments or assignments or rotations there?
I was last there on the 17th of April, and then Glenn went back in July and arrived on the 3rd of July. And despite how short that interval was, there was an incredible amount of change, not only in terms of the fact that I was working out of a different hospital than before. I had been at the European Gaza Hospital, but that had been attacked by Israeli airstrikes and put out of function on the 13th of May. And so I went back to Nasser Hospital, which is a different center. But the problems that we were dealing with in terms of injury patterns had changed to an extent. And the life conditions for all of my colleagues, as well as all the patients, everybody in Gaza, had deteriorated very significantly in that period of time. So what I was looking at was people who had been subjected to starvation since the 2nd of March, when Israel had completed a complete siege on the Gaza Strip, not allowing any food or other aid items in. And I was seeing the early depletion of people's supplies and the stocks that were available through until mid-April when I left in the spring. But when I came back in July, it was so clear how difficult it was for people to access any sort of food. The colleagues that I knew who had moved also from European Gaza Hospital to Nasser Hospital were visibly thinner. And the injuries that we were seeing people get were often related to their attempts to get food for themselves.
This whole idea of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this GHF so-called aid group, and what it amounts to, from reports I've read, is basically a trap and shoot operation more than aid delivery.
I started to ask patients to tell me a bit more about their stories, because when we get the chart and it says gunshot wound or explosive injury, that really doesn't paint a very clear picture about what the circumstances of the injury were. And so time after time, when I had a patient in front of me who had a gunshot wound, I would ask the patients or ask the nurses to help me with translation. What happened? What was happening when you were shot? And people would tell me, almost invariably, almost every gunshot wound that I saw happened in the context of a person going and trying to get aid, usually at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's food distribution points, and being shot. These were patients, some of them were children, 10, 12 years old. Some of them were adult men. I had a man that I asked how he came to be shot in the buttock. And he explained to the nurse that they had been asked to crawl, and the nurse mimed commando crawling on the ground, that here was a man who had gone to get food for his starving family and had been asked to crawl in the sand and then was shot. And he had a severe femur fracture. This would be a difficult injury to recover from, even under the best circumstances. But here's a man that was already so desperate for food that he went to a place where he full well knew he might get shot. And so he's a man that's already malnourished. He's got now even less capacity to get food and feed himself. So all of the possibilities for infectious complications, bone healing, wound healing, he's in such a worse circumstance than he otherwise would have been. And this was true for all of my patients, that regardless of what kind of surgical intervention I could perform, I knew that I had extremely little control over the final outcome because of these much bigger picture things like the availability of clean water, overcrowded living conditions, and a patient's simple ability to get something to feed themselves to be able to heal.
Can you explain what kind of work you're doing while you're in Gaza? Is it the kind of work you'd be doing here in Canada, or are you just filling whatever gaps need to be filled?
So orthopedic surgery means operating on conditions to the bones and joints. Here in Canada, that's often people with arthritis who need hip and knee replacements, or people with broken bones and other conditions that affect the skeleton as well. When I'm in Canada and I'm working in Moose Jaw, I only do emergency trauma care. So in Moose Jaw, my patients also have broken bones. But the difference between somebody who breaks their bone in a car accident or a farming accident or sports injury in Canada versus somebody that's coming into the hospital in Gaza these days is that most of the patients in Gaza are wounded by the weapons of war. So these are weapons that are designed to deliver high energy impact and highly destructive forces. And so not only do I have bone injuries, but I usually am also dealing with soft tissue injuries. And we had three plastic surgeons from the international staff when I was in Gaza for those 2 weeks, and two plastic surgeons from the Palestinian staff. But they were absolutely not able to keep up with the volume of patients with these big, open, gaping wounds. And the environment that all of us were working in, where sometimes we didn't have water in the operating room, we had frequent power outages. Often we couldn't run the air conditioning because we had so little fuel for the generator. So we were sweating into the wounds as we operated on them. And so our ability to treat patients and offer a reasonable outcome was extremely low. And when I left Gaza, at that same time, those three international plastic surgeons also came to the end of their assignments and they left as well. So now we've got orthopedic surgeons there who are picking up that extra gap of soft tissue work. And of course, the two Palestinian plastic surgeons who continue to try to work with this incredibly large volume of war wounded patients. There are very, very capable surgeons in Gaza, but the problem is that there are not enough spaces for them to work in. there are not enough materials for them to make use of some of these injuries that patients have. They would be untreatable in any context because they're so severe. And so it's very hard to compare my life in Canada, my work life in Canada, to my work life in Gaza, because as you say, it's very, very different. It's not so much that I'm trying to fill in wherever I can, because we've got fantastic neurosurgeons, general surgeons, vascular surgeons in Gaza, Palestinian people that are masters of their fields. And so they don't need somebody like me to try to work outside my scope. What they really need is the right materials to work with. They also need to be free from starvation, free from the danger of being bombed in their tents. And they need a cessation of this genocide so that they are not forced to provide medical care for these very critical injured people day in, day out, and working at the absolute maximum of their capabilities.
Well, and that's another aspect of this is the equipment. I was talking to Dorothea Gucciardo recently. She's with glia.org. They provide medical equipment. I'm sure you know Dorothea. I saw you on stage beside her with Eyewitness to Gaza. What about the conditions with the material conditions there that you mentioned, with the equipment, with the necessary, the things necessary for you to do your job? Dorothea was saying that these braces, the names of which I've forgotten right now, that hold people's limbs together after surgery, even something as simple as these braces are hard to find there.
Yes, and you can see that it's a question of absolutely everything having been overused because of so many thousands of wounded patients. And so each time we were doing a surgery, we were never approaching it with having the optimal set of instrumentation and equipment to fix whatever we were dealing with. So we would be cobbling together the remains of leftovers of different sets. We would sometimes be getting a big wire cutter into the operating room itself. And as we were operating, we would cut screws down to the desired size. Now, this left them with jagged edges. It's not very accurate. It crushes the threads. It doesn't leave you with what would here be considered an instrument that was responsible to use on a patient. It's also hard work. It takes time, so it makes our job more difficult. And even something that you might think as simple or interchangeable as a 4-inch bandage versus a 6-inch bandage, when you have a patient who's got 40% of their body burnt and one of their legs is amputated above the knee, it's incredibly hard to bandage that patient with small dressings. And we go through an incredible volume of them. And every time we use something on one patient, we know that that's an item that we can't use on the next patient. And so you find yourself forced to think about rationing healthcare, which is absolutely deplorable.
In a place called Gaza, which is the name given to Hospital Gaza in the first place.
It's an incredibly unfortunate irony, isn't it?
Well, when you were traveling, when I saw you in the spring with Medicine on the Frontier, now you're traveling again. Are you affiliated again, or is this something you're doing on your own, this latest tour?
So I was invited to come back to the Vancouver area by BC Physicians Against Genocide, and they've been doing wonderful work helping me coordinate a few talks here in the Vancouver region. And then through contacts that I've got in Victoria from previous times and from other networks, I reached out to them, and they've done a magnificent job of planning quite a busy schedule, very much at the last minute. So I will be doing a tour of different communities around the island, starting on Gabriola Island, then going to Nanaimo, Duncan, Victoria, and finishing up in Salt Spring Island to be able to do some community lectures in each of those places.
Yes. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Deirdre Noonan. She is a Canadian orthopedic surgeon. She spent years in humanitarian medicine. We're talking today around her latest assignment at Nasser Hospital, Gaza. You were there for 3 weeks. When you talk about the difference between practicing your art here at home in Canada and there, and the horrible conditions that you're under there, I was really struck during your Medicine on the Frontline talk when you talked about your colleagues over there. You mentioned the BC Physicians Against Genocide supporting you on this latest tour. But not all Canadian doctors, and certainly not all Canadian institutions, are so supportive. In fact, the opposite is the case. How do you deal with coming back to Canada after seeing what you've seen there and knowing the role that this country's government and the institutions that are pillars of our society are supporting the onslaught that you are so desperately trying to allay?
It's extremely frustrating and also very, very saddening to see people within a country that, on an institutional level, on a national level, on an individual level, we'd like to think of Canadians as open, as tolerant, as peace-loving. But unfortunately, those are just words. And when you see practices where one human life is valued more than another human life, when we have such vastly different reactions to invasions, to, in quotes, conflict in different areas of the world, it unfortunately brings home the stark truth that in practice, we don't actually regard all human lives as equal. And Palestinian people are people who have been dehumanized and subject to systemic racism in around the world, really, for decades. And it's extremely concerning for me to see how that continues in Canadian institutions, particularly in healthcare, where we are supposed to believe in human life and in the sanctity of life and in the principle of doing no harm and the concept of providing medical care of the same quality to any person, regardless of who they are. And while we keep on stating that those are our values, when I see people wanting to institute policies and or silencing their colleagues and employees from talking about anti-Palestinian racism, it really makes me understand that we don't live the values that we purport to have.
Yes, well, as just lay people, we are taught that the Hippocratic Oath is the holy grail for the medical profession in our society, and that all doctors swear to it and presumably abide by it, where we are seeing all of our institutions now, I guess, in the backdrop of what's happening in Gaza, being revealed for being more hypocritical than Hippocratic.
Sadly, yes.
Well, you talked, and I hesitate somewhat to bring it up, Deirdre, but during your Medicine on the Frontline presentation, you talked a lot about your two colleagues, Mohammed and Mohammed. And just before your appearance in Victoria, you had heard that one of your colleagues had been badly injured. What's the fate of your colleagues now?
I'll talk about Mohammed and Mohammed again when I'm back in Victoria, so I can give a more comprehensive update for people who had heard that portion of their story. I was able to see Mohammed again when I was working at Nasser Hospital. He had gone from European Gaza Hospital to Nasser Hospital to work there. And so we were able to see each other, and he gave me updates about his family and how he himself was continuing to cope with all of this trauma around him. We talked about the death of his father that occurred months ago. And he also kept me updated about Mohammed, who was our mutual colleague, who was injured in an explosive attack just outside a store that his family had used to keep water and bread that they gave to the needy people in the area. And Mohammed had a head injury. He was in the ICU and intubated. And we knew from his initial CT scans that there was going to be a potential loss for his vision. And I'm very grateful that in many ways, Mohammed has made a good recovery. We have been able to speak on the phone, and he is right back to his original self in terms of his thinking, his expression. But what has not come back is his eyesight. And so he has very, very limited vision. He's able to see some colors and movement. And if he brings his phone screen right up to his eye, he can make out some very large text on it. But it's not a functional amount of vision that would allow him to return to work as an anesthetist. We've been told by the neurologist that he's got potential for recovery for up to 6 months after the injury. But we're already at coming up to 4 months soon here. And so I'm extremely afraid that he will be functionally blind for the rest of his life, and he will have to adapt to a condition that won't let him complete his training and work as an anesthetist.
One thinks about the waste. You talked so glowingly about the talents of your colleagues, and despite their young age, how accomplished they were, and how promising their careers could be. It's shattering to hear this news.
It is, and I know that sometimes I'm even sugarcoating it a bit for myself because I'm thinking of Mohanad's future, of his career. But realistically as well, we don't even have any sort of guarantee that these two young men or anyone around them is going to survive to get to the point of having a future, to get to the point of having a career that both of them are struggling to feed themselves. And both of them face the possibility of imminent death from these explosive attacks, from snipers, from drone attacks, tank fire all the time.
Well, not all of the medical profession is complicit in this. There is a coalition, a Canadian medical coalition against genocide. There are a number of different groups, people organizing, and it's not only in the medical field. In their statement, they've written letters to, of course, to the government and whatnot. Part of one of their letters that I found quite poignant is, and I'll just quote it briefly, for Canadians, it says, "Canada is not neutral. By continuing military exports and diplomatic protection, the government is complicit in these crimes. Silence in the face of genocide is complicity. That, I would argue, includes we citizens that remain silent on the sidelines." There doesn't seem to be enough even those that aren't silent can do. Obviously, it's not stopping. Again, during your last talk, Deirdre, you said something that moved me greatly. You were talking about taking your violin with you and how that was, you said, the best thing that you could have brought along with you. And you said that in when playing for your colleagues and friends, seeing the serenity that they experienced listening to your playing, you said that if you'd done nothing else in that time that you'd been in Gaza, that the tiny moment of serenity that you brought to your friends, then that might have been enough. I know it's hard to understand in the face of such a great calamity what we can do, but what can we do?
So when I come back to Canada, I share in this feeling of being disempowered that so many people who care a great deal in Canada do feel, because it feels like we're a long way away. It feels like even the greatest gestures and the greatest actions that we can do are ineffectual. But I would much rather keep on struggling for what I believe is right, even if I am not certain of its effectiveness, then give up and stop trying. So I think there are so many things that people can engage in that they are already engaged in, but hopefully that more people can join in. And there are, as you said, numerous groups. Two that we can maybe mention again are the BC Physicians Against Genocide and Victoria's Healthcare Workers Against Genocide. But of course, many, many other groups at the grassroots level in most communities in Canada now. So those places are wonderful resources for people to go and connect with, find people that are like-minded, and join their voices in actions that are already underway. We've seen recently in Burnaby that the city of Burnaby has become Canada's first apartheid-free community on the city level, and they've also become a weapons embargo city and have pledged to support the Palestinian family reunification for families for Gaza. And this is something that can be replicated in other communities in Canada. This is very meaningful, whether that community is big or small, because it makes a change on an official level that signals to our higher levels of government where the will of the Canadian people lies and our desire not to be complicit in a genocide. People can also join together in visible protests, in trying to encourage their organizations on professional and other levels, whether it is a church or whether it is a union or whether it is a professional body, to ask for statements to be made, for those organizations to divest, and to ask for those divest organizations to do meaningful solidarity with Palestinian people. We can look at our own economic footprint. Where do we buy from? What do we invest in? How can we make ourselves and how we use our money more coherent with the morals that we have and the things that we're asking our Canadian government to do? And we can take our voices to government offices as well and try to make sure that Canadian Parliament is doing its job of representing Canadian people, representing what we want done, which the majority is not to participate in a genocide.
Well, and you people can come out and see you to find out more information, and they can do that here. As I said, you're going to be on the island. You're at Gabriola first, the smaller island, 7 p.m. on the 10th. That's Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Gabriola Agricultural Hall. That's down on South Road. People live there will know it. You're coming over on September 11th to Nanaimo. You'll be doing two engagements in Nanaimo Thursday, September 11th, one at 3 p.m. at St. Andrew's UC Hall. That's on Fitzwilliam. And again at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Island University. That's VIU building 180. That's at Wakasaya. You'll find it. And you'll be down in Duncan Friday the 12th. At Duncan United at 7 p.m., doors at 6:30, and here in Victoria, up at St. Aidan's again at Broadview United at 7 p.m., where I saw you the last time you were here in May, a very nice venue that is, and then over to Salt Spring again onto the smaller islands, 1:30 All Saints by the Sea Anglican. That's 1:30 Tuesday, September 16th, a busy time for you, indeed. How are you keeping pace so far?
So far, it's been possible thanks to the incredible people who are doing the real legwork of the organization and making sure that I'm so well taken care of that all I have to do is show up with some slides and speak. So that's been invaluable, and I also find that it's helpful for me to be able to meet with other people that want to hear about Gaza, to talk about the experiences I've had and the incredible people I've worked alongside, and be able to make good on my promise to them that I will not let their stories go forgotten.
Well, it's an inspiration to speak with you, Deirdre, Dr. Deirdre Noonan. Thanks again for coming on, Deirdre, and good luck with the rest of your tour. Eh?
Thank you so much.
Dr. Deirdre Noonan from an interview I did with her last month. Those dates, of course, don't count. I want to also thank Dan Kobolik for coming on the show. That's all I've got for this week. Until the next time.
Ain't it something how a heart can melt like that? Just from a single picture frame. How an image can make sense of everything that matters, and you don't even need to know her name. Because we all know children just like her. We want to make them safe and hold them tight. And we can't imagine how someone could do this. Create such a sight. She was maybe 3 years old. With a mop of curly brown hair. Despondent, standing on the ruins of her home. Clutching little teddy bear. I might forget the details of whatever it was I read, but that photograph is seared in my mind. The photo of the girl that was a photo of all the children, all of humankind. The greatest lessons that I ever could have learned. didn't come from all the stories that were filed, nor from all the speeches or statistics, but from one photo of a broken little child. She was maybe 3.